quantum gravity minus one. Yesterday, I wrapped up the discussion of about the canonical quantization of gravity with a brief synopsis of the setups and results that have come out of loop quantum gravity, its status quo. We saw that one still faces quite difficult problems in completing this quantization program. And many of them have to do with this, well, the status of the Hamiltonian constraint, what's the right form of it, is it the correct Hamiltonian, the versions that have been proposed, and what is then ultimately, well, the true physical phase space. And quite, well, little is known about that. And we had then turned our attention back to an alternative way of doing things, using a non-perturbative version of the path integral. And so this time, well, it's both not perturbative, in contrast to the discussion we had initially in the course, and it's also kind of background independent. It doesn't a priori distinguish any particular geometry. Now, I personally regard this as the currently most promising way of proceeding to try and understand quantum gravity, and that's not just a mere belief, but really based on some concrete results and evidence that has come out of this over the last 10 years or so. Okay, now, in illustrating how one proceeds, well, one is working quite an analogy with the quantization, the path integral quantization of the non-relativistic particle. So that's a useful analogy to think of. So let me remind you how that went. Now, also, so that was a problem that one can solve, starting by a regularization of the sum or the integral over all paths. So kind of the general instruction is to take a quantum superposition of paths, kind of virtual paths the particle could have taken, and superposing as a corresponding complex phase factors, and then just see whether one can make sense of this object. So one way of proceeding introduces these kind of regularized paths. And what's a regularized path? Well, in contrast to, say, just a smooth curve in R3, in order to know the regularized path, you just have to give me a finite set of data. Yeah? So, and one way of doing this, so just a finite bunch of numbers, not a function as such. So one way of doing this was to just specify at some discrete time intervals where in X space the particle is. So you start out by its position at time t equal to 0, and then at x2 x0, x1 is x at time delta t, x2 is x at time 2 delta t, and then you finish after a finite number of steps. So xn is your x at n times delta t, right? And the picture you have was there. And then by definition, you take the path in between these locations as a straight. Now, so then you have here kind of your x naught, and you're proceeding, well, in time. So each one of those is associated with the identical unit in time, delta t. And so here, on 2, 3, 4, 5, the path is characterized just by giving you kind of five numbers, right? instead of an entire function, x of t, which would be required to characterize a continuous, a general smooth path. Now, what one does then, of course, in the end, so one, for fixed n, one keeps the endpoints of these things, the path fixed, and one sums over all piecewise straight paths of n steps. Okay, and then, well, that is one's regularized path integral. And then after, or a recrutated, one uses usually a recrutated version of that, as I also or have already mentioned. And then one considers a continuum limit, where one lets these time intervals go to zero, and at the same time one lets number of steps go to infinity. And well, then one can simply derive more or less rigorously as a path interval. Now, what's the analog of that in gravity? We have already briefly mentioned this. So we certainly will have to regularize. Now we'll do that for the purposes of formulating the regularized path integral. We use a version where a path now, of course, that should be a space-time geometry. But now we're looking for a regularized version of this. And we'll take it to be a more or less a direct analog of this piecewise straight path of the particle. We choose it to be piecewise straight, or I could also say piecewise flat. That's a more usual way of phrasing it. Space-time. Now, there is a difference with the path here of the non-relativistic particle. Here, of course, one is given a background space, which is just Euclidean 3 space usually. So there is a metric there. And with respect to this metric, well, these are just straight segments. Now, in gravity, of course, there is no embedding space. So the space times, they're not embedded in anything. And all that the dynamics will depend on is the intrinsic geometry, the intrinsic curvature properties of these space times. Yeah, so just keep that a slightly a different structure that you find here in gravity. And there is a beautiful idea of kind of how to approximate smooth space times using piecewise flat building blocks. That was first proposed for using in the classical theory of GR. So say to solve the Einstein equations approximately, because the Einstein equations are very difficult set of nonlinear PDEs to solve. So one way of trying to do this approximately is via such a discretization. And it went by the name given by the person who first introduced these structures in gravity, Recher, Italian physicist, GR without coordinates. And that already catches, in a very succinct, succinct manner, the nice properties, apart from, you know, constituting a regularization, that these piecewise flat geometries have. So what does this prescription consist in? Well, one works with, instead of smooth manifolds, curved manifolds, one works with simplicial manifolds. So I explain in a second what this means. So classically thinking, one approximates a general curved manifold by a simplicial complex, or more specifically, actually, a simplicial manifold. What is that? It's an object you get by gluing triangular building blocks together. So if you were in 2D, you would be approximating, say, a two-dimensional curved surface by little triangles that are individually flat. So they're not, the triangles are not themselves curved, because you can glue them together in a way that you approximate curved surfaces. And of course, classically, you can do that the better, the smaller, the finer your triangulation is. And of course, well, you might say, well, why triangles? Why not squares? Well, triangles explore very well curved geometries. They're kind of optimally in any dimension used for approximating curved structures. And that's one thing that people use, for instance, in animations. So you often see that little animations, actually, they're based on just some smoothed out version where things are, you know, triangulated and approximate curved surfaces. Yes?
Am I correct that any square relations that can be turned into a triangulation just by cutting a square?
That's right. But so that wouldn't be a general, of course, then you would miss curvature. Yeah. Well, we are interested in the triangulation and its metric properties. And what I'm just claiming that I give you an arbitrary curved surface, and I give you n flat squares, and I give you n flat triangles. And my claim is you get a better approximation of the same curved surface if you use the triangles rather than the squares. I'm not making this argument rigorous, but this is just, this is how it works. So that is a kind of the classical use of a triangulation. So, but this works in, so it works in any dimension. In 2D, it's obviously where you have triangles, very easy to visualize. In 3D, you have tetrahedra. In 4D, you have four simplices. In 5D, you have five simplices, and so forth. So, so the idea, the original idea, is now that instead of giving you a set of data in an M differential manifold and a smooth metric, G mean U of X, you approximate that by a triangulation. And what are the analogs of kind of the discrete set of coordinates I gave you to specify the piecewise straight path? Well, the intrinsic analogs are to give you the edge length of all the triangular building blocks that appear in this triangulation. So I square them, not just a convention. So if I have n, if my triangulation consists of n links, then I have n such assignments of squared length variables. So that's just an example of a two-dimensional triangulation. And of course, everything is known about this geometry if I give you all the edge lengths, L1 squared, L2 squared, L3 squared, etc. The reason why one sticks to these squares is that it allows one naturally to talk about time-like and space-like link edge lengths, so and light-like, if you want to. Yeah. So all signatures. This construction works also not just in any dimension; it works also with any signature. So that's also very nice. So that here denotes a triangulation. By that I mean it specifies how the individual triangular building blocks are glued together. So how kind of their faces are identified pairwise in order to construct kind of a continuous piece of geometry. And one always here, or one usually works, with manifolds. So of course you can glue even 2D triangles. You can glue them in extremely screwy ways. But one always glues them in such a way that a manifold results. So when you look locally, everything looks always like you have two-dimensional little neighborhoods. Okay, now where are the geometric degrees of freedom in here? kind of how are they now encoded in such a triangulation with edge labels indicating their length. Well, they're encoded in, as I already said, kind of the connectivity of T. So how kind of the building blocks are glued together. And secondly, in these assignments of edge lengths. Now, so the really nice thing to emphasize, of course, is this fact that one is at no stage introducing any coordinates, right? So one just takes kind of the length of these edges, and this kind of gives you a rigid skeleton for most purposes that fixes the intrinsic geometry completely. So we've never had to introduce coordinates. These are, in fact, of course, since every triangle by definition is just flat, these are geodesic lengths, right? So they don't transform anymore. I mean, the diffeomorphisms don't act anymore on them. So you're really giving kind of the pure geometric data. So you got rid of the redundancy that is in these G mu nus at the same time as regularizing. And well, it's of course very much kind of a rods and clocks scenario where, well, you have kind of not natural paths that go along edges, which have kind of discrete, which have certain lengths associated with them. So this is then my second ingredient here. The squared edge length. So as I said, it works in any dimension, any signature. So what are these Simplicial building blocks? So when one is in D dimensions, one will glue together kind of D-dimensional blocks, and they are called then D simplices. And, well, let's work our way up in dimensions. What's a zero simplex? Easy. It's just a point. What's a one simplex? Well, it's a straight edge. What's a two simplex? It's a flat, a triangle. A three simplex, it's a tetrahedron. Well, now things start, you know, being slightly difficult to draw. That's a four simplex, etc. And by definition, the interior geometry is flat. So it's, from a GR point of view, it's trivial. Right. So by definition, or by definition, for all of these building blocks is holes, of course it starts being non-trivial in D equal to 2, interior geometry. It's flat. So you can say, if you do this in Euclidean space, you can think of these objects as being cut out of a flat Euclidean plane three space, right? Just cut along these edges. Here the same, here the same. If they carry a Minkowski structure, then you can just think of them as being kind of cut out of flat Minkowski space. And of course, if you have a Minkowski structure, then the flat metric on the interior will know about where the light rays go in a way. So if I, this was cut out of a 2D Lorentzian flat space-time, then, for example, I could just draw kind of my light cones, and I would know kind of where, how the light, what the trajectories of light rays are. So what the segments of a squared edge length zero are. I mean, there would just be some kind of straight lines passing through your triangle, your tetrahedron, or your four simplex. So the beauty of this is kind of twofold. First of all, it implements a regularization. You know, again, I just give you some finite list of data. A way I could specify the connectivity for you. I mean, one way you would practically go about it is say, let's imagine we're in 2D. I hand you n of these triangles. Let's, for simplicity, assume that there are equilateral, so there are no restrictions which one I can glue to which one. Then I give them labels, explicit labels, from 1 to n. Then I make a big n by n matrix. And whenever two of them share an edge, I put a 1 in the matrix, otherwise I put a 0. That gives what one calls a connectivity matrix that completely specifies how things are glued together. And, well, and then I add just a, well, more generally, of course, I need to add a list of the lengths here. Now, so, and the beauty is that this is kind of pure geometry. So there's no coordinate freedom involved anywhere. Now, if you insist, you can, you're free to reintroduce coordinates and a metric. Of course, this is highly non-unique because there are so many choices you can make for each one. You will arrive at different forms of the metrics. Then you're just reinstating this redundancy inherent in here. So just to give you an example of what this looks like, so if you really wanted to, you can reintroduce a metric or a metric. For example, let's again look at d equal to 2. Now, usually this will only be possible, I mean, this reintroducing of coordinates and a metric for either a single building block or kind of pairs of adjacent building blocks. I mean, so generally speaking, it will have to do that building block by building block. But what's, so let's us now think. Take an example where we are given such a little triangle. We have specific assignments for these. It doesn't matter actually whether these are positive, negative, or zero. Now, let me introduce a coordinate system where I just choose arbitrarily one of the vertices as the origin of my coordinate system. And then I just put the kind of two unit vectors. I could call them ex, ey. I let them just lie along two of the edges. Now, this defines now a non-orthogonal coordinate system. And if you re-express, if you now look at what the metric for this flat piece of space is, in this coordinate system, then you will find that it looks like this. L1 squared, 1/2, L1 squared plus L2 squared minus L3 squared. Same here, 1/2, L1 squared plus L2 squared minus L3 squared, and L2 squared. So this diagonal form, that's something you'll check in the exercises this afternoon. it's not recommended to do that. It's completely superfluous. And of course, as I said, it's the beauty of this whole setup that it can do without without the reintroduction of coordinates. Okay, now the building blocks are individually flat. So in what way do curvature properties get encoded? Well, again, that's kind of nicest and easiest to see in two dimensions. And of course, it has to do with how these flat triangles or higher dimensional symplices are glued together. So the notion, so there is a notion of local, of course, intrinsic, goes without saying. Curvature, and it's actually kind of Gaussian curvature. And it's related to a quantity that's called the deficit angle. And I'll draw a picture in a second to explain this concept. So the deficit angle, little delta, is given by 2 pi minus sum over I sharing h of a bunch of angles alpha I. Now, what's Gaussian curvature? Should be familiar from kind of geometry of curved two surfaces. I mean, in 2D, well, it's a two-dimensional notion, and it's essentially up to a factor 2, the scalar curvature or the Ricci scalar locally. That's the Gaussian curvature. Or the product of what are they called? The mean curvatures. If you introduce a coordinate system, adapted coordinate system, to measure the curvature, you know, of a little piece of curved two space, then you can extract eigenvalues, curvature eigenvalues. You multiply them, you get the Gaussian curvature. Now, the deficit angle is a missing angle. Is an angle which describes deviation from 2 pi. So what is the general situation here one has in mind? Here's the I. It labels kind of building blocks. If we are in D dimensions, it labels D-dimensional building blocks, symplices. So triangular building blocks, sharing a d minus 2-dimensional simplicial building block, which is called a hinge. And this is very, so that's a curvature, notion of curvature, again, neatly illustrated in two dimensions. So let me assume I'm in two dimensions. So now this instructs me to look at two-dimensional building blocks, that is triangles, that share a given d minus two-dimensional building block, which is a zero-dimensional building block, which is just a vertex. So that's what I'm considering. I look at a vertex, and I look at all the triangles that share this vertex. Now, so this is my vertex here. So I have now a bunch of triangles, whatever, big and small. And the angles, the corresponding angles, here are the alphas, I label alpha 1, alpha 2, whatever, alpha alpha k. Now, what I've already done, so I've assumed a situation where these alphas, they don't already don't add up to 2 pi. And so originally, so this was glued to here, right, originally. That was the piece of triangulation I was looking at. But in order to put it out in the plane, I had to cut this open and kind of iron it flat out in the plane. And now this angle here is exactly what one calls the deficit angle. So what's missing to 2 pi? So and from this formula, you see, so if the head, if the alpha angles had added up to 2 pi, well, this would be 0. And also, of course, the curvature would be 0. Then I would be just sitting on a locally on a piece of flat space. If this delta is positive, so there's a positive angle missing, then this comes out to be a positively curved surface. I mean, like a two-sphere or something, I mean, locally. Conversely, if, you know, after cutting this open, you know, there would have been a non-trivial overlap here of triangles, then there would have then been more than a 2 pi angle. So there would have been kind of an excess angle or a negative deficit angle. Of course, that would be characteristic of a kind of a saddle point geometry. If you think of embedding this in some ambient 3 space, it's obvious then, you know, you have to squeeze in more of these triangles that will only work out if you have a kind of saddle point in geometry. Okay. So this is actually in 2D, this is in a straightforward manner, this delta, that it just is Gaussian curvature, 2D curvature. When you are in higher dimensions, so let us think of this setup in one dimension higher. Then you're looking at tetrahedra. So these, you're building some 3 geometry from flat tetrahedra. Now, what this instructs you to do in order kind of to determine Gaussian curvature, in a, you should take an edge, that's a 1 simplex, and then this edge will be shared by a bunch of 3-dimensional tetrahedra. Okay. And then, well, difficult to draw for me. How to do this. Well, is this right? Yes, that's more or less right. So that's, you have to think about it in a 3D way. So there is a bunch of kind of tetrahedra that kind of go around this hinge or this one-dimensional simplex. And what you are counting, and of course here, this will be, if I look now at this tetrahedron, there will be kind of a wedge, right? And then you're measuring just the angle of this wedge, and the angle gives you, well, it is a measure for the curvature of the 2 plane, which is perpendicular on this hinge object. And of course, if you look, if you then want to construct, like, curvature tensor, or if you want to construct, say, the Ricci scalar in 3 dimensions or in higher dimensions, of course, you know from the classical construction of what you're doing in order in the continuum, it actually is a sum of a Gaussian curvature of all possible 2 planes you can put through a point. And you see, you can mimic this in a very nice way in these triangulated spaces of space-time. And the general prescription, so did I want to leave this there? Perhaps. Yes, I wanted to leave this here. So that was the remark about connectivity. Let me go to here. So in particular, how are you now going to rewrite kind of the classical action for GR? So the curvature term, I'm just omitting the kappa squared, the gravitational constant, which was, now let me specify, well, let me do this in d dimensions. It works in any dimension. The curvature term will be a d-dimensional integral over square root of the modulus of the determinant of the d-dimensional Ricci scalar. Now, what does this become in my simplicial approximation? It becomes exactly a sum I in the triangulation, where I again labels a simplex of dimension d minus 2. What I have to do, kind of in order to get the analog of this integral, I have to perform a discrete sum over all the deficit angles around all the hinges. And each one of them, each term in the sum, I weigh in addition with the volume of the hinge itself. For the case that I am in dimension 2, of course, this vertex has, well, by definition, volume 1. But of course, it becomes non-trivial in higher dimensions. In 3D, it would be the length of the hinge around which things happen. In 4D, which is the physically relevant case, then the hinge is a two-dimensional triangle, and the weight would be then the volume, the 2D volume of that triangle. So let me write it down. The volume of the ice D minus 2 simplex times, for that 2 simplex, the corresponding deficit angle, delta, as defined here. So that is the kind of discretized version of the curvature term of the action. And of course, we will be having a cosmological constant term in there. So that's, of course, even more straightforward. That's the volume term, of course, makes sense whenever m is compact. And this becomes, in my simplicial picture, simply a sum over building blocks I that make up my triangulation capital T of top dimension. And I just take, well, I sum over them. And for each of them, of course, I compute what the volume is. And then I add them all up. So I hope that doesn't require much of an explanation. And of course, if you have kind of surfaces, say, or sub-manifolds in your simplicial, big simplicial manifold of dimension d, then of course you can also compute volumes of those, yeah, correspondingly. Now, your task is now, of course, the discrete degrees of freedom that are given to you, well, there were those, kind of the connectivity and the edge length. So these were the Li squareds. So now, well, it's just a trigonometric exercise to express, say, expression for the deficit angle as a function of the length squared. Of course, that can be done. I mean, every geometric intrinsic property is a function, well, of the gluing and of these Li squareds. Yeah. So in general, you will express both the volumes and the angle as a function of these squared edge lengths. And then you have your, well, kind of you rewrite what was your classical action, say Einstein-Hilbert action, of the metric G mu nu. You now have a discretized version, let me call this S regi, which depends on the way the gluing is done and the edge length assignments. Now, in contrast, of course, to how Reggie Hugh first introduced these ideas, our interest is not to use that classically, but to now substitute in the past integral the ill-defined integral over all space-time histories with a well-defined sum over regularized histories, where each one of the histories will now be represented by such a triangulation, characterized by a finite set of data. Okay. Now, and there are essentially two ways of implementing this in the state sum in the quantum theory. Or sum over histories. So the first goes by the name of quantum regi calculus. So the original kind of way of doing GR without coordinates with these triangles, that's called regi calculus. And well, people still use that. It's actually a tool in numerical relativity. So various versions of that. But we are interested in the quantum version of that. So quantum regi calculus, or QRC for short. And the way one proceeds there is one fixes the connectivity. Of course, you have to sum over a kind of all possible space time. So the way it's done there, one fixes the connectivity, so a specific triangulation, and then one allows this geodesic edge length to vary. And of course, having different assignments of LR squares, you will just get different curved objects, piecewise flat, but of course, overall curved objects. Fix T, and then integrate over all Li or Li squared. Now one has to pay a little bit attention because not all combinations of Li's are admissible or Li squared. And why is that? Well, that can already be seen from a single triangle, L1. L2, L3. Let me assume this is just a Euclidean flat triangle. Then, of course, triangle inequalities have to be obeyed. That is, well, you know, the sum of two of these must always be smaller or equal than the length of this here. So. Sorry, the other way around. So the sum of two of these cannot be smaller than the third edge, and this, of course, for all permutations of the situation. So the integration here, so the path integral will contain an integration over Li's, but for each building block, triangle inequalities have to be built in. So it's in no way an unrestricted integration over all the L's of all the individual edges that live in your triangulation. So actually, in a very complex manner, of course, you imagine when you now start building things, you know, from these triangles, Well, they're all coupled together, obviously, in this triangulation. So there will be many kind of algebraically kind of complicated relations induced by these inequalities. Yes?
So, unless I'm mistaken, if you have a very large triangle in like a very curved space, then it doesn't have to obey the triangle inequality. So is there any reason to believe that there won't be like small deviations from the triangle inequality?
I'm purely looking locally at the level of how do I label these geometries. And I'm just saying just at the level of individual triangles. So there's no large scale.
Oh, right, the triangle is flat, okay.
They're flat, that's right. Yeah. So they're by definition, they're flat. So this problem always occurs kind of locally. Now, there's an alternative way of doing it, kind of a complementary way, you could say. And that's called dynamical triangulation. Where you're doing precisely the reverse. So you're fixing the squared edge lengths, all of them, to one or two values. Two values if you are in Minkowskian and you want to distinguish between time and space line. But essentially, you fix all of them to a common value, and you allow the connectivity to change. So fix Li squared to some unit length, so plus minus A squared. And then sum over all t, subject to local manifold conditions. So you have to be careful, of course, to obey those. So in a way, then the task of performing kind of the path integral is given, you know, say a bundle of n triangles, how many inequivalent ways are there to put them together to construct distinct piecewise flat curved spaces or spacetimes. Now, the second approach, which we'll be kind of focusing our attention on in what follows, has a number of advantages compared to this first one. First of all, there is generally no continuous invariance left. So one can actually show, well, the Li's, of course, in this first approach, they're still continuous variables. And it can so happen that locally, some shifts in these lengths or some continuous transformation in local edge lengths, kind of bunch of edges that, say, share a vertex, may not change actually the retroaction. This doesn't happen here. Actually, you got rid of all continuous variables kind of altogether in doing that. Now, another advantage is that the action for a finite number of building blocks, so for a finite triangulation, is finite in dynamical triangulations, whereas it still has divergences in quantum matrix calculus. And that comes from the fact that you can have, if you are allowed arbitrary edge lengths, what you can form is you can form very highly curved regions of space-time. For example, if you imagine you are in 2D, you glue things from triangles, and you let them degenerate so that all the triangles become very long and narrow, and you glue them kind of together in a little cone, you will get very, very high curvature, whereas the volume is very small because they're kind of thin triangles. So it actually turns out that the path integral needs additional kind of cutoffs put in here in order to render it finite, even with just a finite number of building blocks. The presence of these triangle inequalities, moreover, makes it impossible, even in lower dimensions, to analytically tackle these models at all, the quantum models. So that's another drawback. And that's also not true here. One can actually exactly solve models in 2D. OK, so let us Oh yeah, and lastly, and very importantly, this so far has been studied for Euclidean signature, whereas this works for either signature, and in particular for the Lorentzian signature of space that we're interested in. So this is what you'll be looking at. Okay, let me just take 5 more minutes. So what form of the regularized path integral have we now arrived at? Well, path integral, I'm using the symbol z. Now, if you think back to the particle case, of course, I have now introduced the regularization, but of course, in order, well, I still have to, I do my calculations, and then in the end, of course, I want to remove the regulators again in a well-defined manner. And if divergences appear, I want to get rid of them in a well-defined manner. That's, of course, what renormalization does for you. So the same, of course, will be true in gravity here. And of course, things will diverge at some stage, but we'll see. Well, this is what happens. They can be renormalized consistently, leaving you with a finite result. But anyway, part of the construction, certainly of the path integral, will therefore be a continuum limit, where again, kind of the characteristic edge lengths of these triangles will be shrunk to 0, at the same time as the number of building blocks, sorry, will go to infinity. And so let me write this sum, explain what the ingredients in the sum are, what the symbols mean, and then we'll stop for the day. So this is a sum over inequivalent triangulations. Tn, I explain the symbols in a minute, so it's a kind of a measure factor here included, Ct. And then I have my weights. And I use now, of course, a regular prescription for each of the triangulations to work out kind of what the Einstein-Hilbert contribution is. OK, let me explain all the symbols. Now, this is my this was a characteristic kind of edge length. So think of that as kind of a UV cutoff, which, of course, I want to remove. I want to make the grid finer and finer. This is, of course, in a way, an arbitrary way I've chosen to regularize things. So I want to get rid of as much as possible of this arbitrary regularization properties. Now, here's this. Of course, this is my kind of continuum limit I've already talked about, which I'll have to perform in some manner. Now, what one usually does, n is a number, so n is a number of building blocks of d-dimensional building blocks. And the way this continuum limit is performed is holding something one thinks of as a physical volume, let me call this V phys, which is up to some finite constant, will be of the form A to the D. So that's your cutoff, that kind of to render this quantity dimensionful, times N being kept finite while one takes this continuum limit. Now, here I have another element to explain. Now, what is this? This is the order of the automorphism group of the triangulation T. What means order? Just the number of elements. the automorphism group of T is the group that maps T onto itself. So sometimes you can have a T that has particular symmetries, so it might then have a non-trivial automorphism group. And if there are such symmetries, you have to divide. So then these things, the term obtains an additional weight in the path integral, in this path sum. Now, Tn is the space of triangulations with at most n building blocks. Okay, so triangulations with smaller or equal to n building blocks. And well, that's about everything else you should recognize. The path integral has been turned into a discrete sum. I just have to count these different ways of gluing things together into manifolds. This is a democratic sum in that each equivalent triangulation is counted, appears just once. And unless it has a particular symmetry, and you can show that these symmetries are extremely rare when you get to larger triangulations, because they have to be kind of accidental, you know, like this half of the triangulation has to be look exactly like that half, and then I kind of rotate, you know, it in a non-trivial way onto itself. So these become extremely rare. So for large n, this is almost always just one. But what this one can show is actually kind of a remnant of a property that the de Witt measure on the space of geometries also has. It's a property I haven't mentioned to you when we talked about this as a metric on the space of metrics. It actually gives a lower weight to a geometry with special symmetries. So if your geometry has a non-trivial isometry group, then it will count, will contribute less to the sum. So, and that's also why one gets kind of a stratified orbit space in the continuum. And this is kind of, how it looks, that same construction in this discrete context. Okay, and what one can do with this, I'll let you know tomorrow in the last of our lectures. See you then.
How arbitrary two manifolds can